Today's community news makes conversation the great southern sounds of Melbourne, 88.3 Southern FM.
You're listening to the Space Show with Andrew Rennie. 2014 is the 50th anniversary of the establishment of the Deep Space Network. This is a worldwide set of antennae that send commands to spacecraft throughout the solar system and receive data from them. If you've seen pictures of Mercury, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, Neptune, or Uranus, they arrived at Earth via the Deep Space Network. On this evening's The Space Show, we celebrate Australia's role in the Deep Space Network. Today, one of the three main tracking stations of the Deep Space Network is at Tidbinbilla. A dedicated band of Australian technicians have a key role in the Canberra Deep Space Communications Complex. Now retired, Keith Aldworth was an analog instrumentation technician at Tidbinbilla. I spoke to him outdoors beside the 70-metre dish. And don't be put off by the occasional wind rumble.
And what was your role here?
I came here in 1966 after a year at Woomera. I came here as an analog instrumentation technician, and I stayed here for 11 years. Left in late 1977. I was involved in the commissioning of this thing, the big antenna, mainly in fitting it out when it was built, cabling and the like, which was fairly strenuous work, fairly dirty work in some places too, because there's a tunnel that links the operations building to the base of the antenna, through which all the cables run, and it was quite a dark and damp place to work in those days.
And a bit like putting in the NBN fiber optics now.
I think they get it a bit easier these days.
Yes.
Yes. So it was all very exciting stuff. And during the Apollo missions, before this was constructed, we used to go up to Parkes. A team of us used to go to the Parkes Radio Telescope just for a six-week period around the Apollo mission time. And we'd spend a couple of weeks commissioning our equipment up there, and then a couple of weeks of mission time, and then the following week or 2 weeks decommissioning again to come back here. So for each Apollo mission up until 17, I think, was the first one, was done here, but all the others were done at Parkes. So it was a very, very busy time, very exciting time, and I'm so thankful to have been a part of it. I just loved every minute. It was really great.
So what else did you do during your career?
When I left here?
Well, before then,
Before I came, before I went to Woomera, I was in the Royal Air Force. I was a radar technician. I left the Royal Air Force in 64, came to Australia in 65, and worked for a year at Woomera and then 11 years here. And then I went to the University of Queensland, where I worked the rest of my working life. Retired at age 55, and I now live at Noosa on the Sunshine Coast.
Oh, wonderful. So it must bring back a lot of memories to be here today.
It certainly does, yes. This is the second time we've been back to one of these functions. That we came back for the Apollo 11 40th anniversary in 2009. So this is the second time I've been back. It's the first time I've been out here since I left it. So very interesting.
Any particular missions come to mind? Were you involved in those, or were you sort of on the sidelines when they happened, having done the technical work?
Well, most people have probably forgotten the missions I was involved in. When I first came here, we were doing Pioneer 10 and Pioneer 11.
Pioneer 11, just a few days ago, had its 40th anniversary of its launch.
Yes, that's right, but we were still up in Queensland, so we didn't get to hear about any celebrations for that. But Mariner missions, the early Mariner missions we did, Mars.
The Mariner, yes.
Mariner, Mars, and Venus too, the Venus missions. Viking had been launched or was about to be launched, I think, when I left here. I'm not quite sure of the facts there, but
It was launched 75, landed in July 76, if I remember correctly.
Yes. So, yeah, there's a few that I can remember. And, of course, the Surveyor missions, who could forget those? And we did all of those here, but not with 43, with 42. And the first unmanned landings, soft landings on the moon, which was quite fascinating. And Colin McKellar has actually got quite a lot of material that I gave him, photographs and things that we took here at the time of recording them. So they're on the Honeysuckle website if anybody's interested.
Yes. Were you surprised that the Viking landers operated on Mars for so long?
I think everyone was. I don't think they were expected to last very long at all. But they didn't. We didn't know very much about the environment on Mars. I mean, they really were pathfinders. And it's probably not such a great surprise now to know that they survived for such a long time.
Yes, of course, Spirit and Opportunity lasted a long time, and Opportunity is still going.
That's right, exactly, yes. And, thanks to your previous missions that told us a bit about what they'd have to encounter up there. So, very helpful.
Now, how essential is Chidbenbilla to the overall worldwide tracking of mainly American spacecraft?
Well, it is absolutely essential because they have to have 24-hour coverage, and because they're equally spaced around the world, they can get 24-hour coverage. Without this station, they'd be missing a slab.
So the other stations are at Goldstone
and Madrid.
Yeah, Goldstone being just out of Los Angeles. And that pretty much puts them 120 degrees apart?
Approximately, yes, that's right. So,
presumably, while you're tracking one spacecraft in one direction, another planet's in another direction, and you're tracking another spacecraft in Goldstone?
That happened, yes. In fact, we supported multiple missions here from time to time, yeah. And, of course, they do now all of the time because they've got several antennas and they can really... they can cover a lot of things, and I don't think these days, I'm not absolutely sure about it, but I don't think they track from over the horizon to going back over the horizon. I think they do bits of it, and they switch between missions that way. We used to acquire a spacecraft on the horizon as it rose and track it all the way across the sky until it set. And, of course, with something like Apollo, where you've got to have the 24-hour coverage, that's the only way you can do it.
Yes.
But some of the other missions, like Pioneer, and they're not doing anything particular. You know, they're just sending back constant data and no big significant events for long periods of time. Probably not necessary to track them all of the time. I don't know. I'm just supposing, but I would suggest that that's probably what they do.
Now, when you say you track them from horizon to horizon, from when a planet rises to when it sets, it'd be about 10 hours or so?
Yes, it would be. I'm not sure what the actual tracking time here be. I'd say probably be about 10 hours, yes.
And people might be familiar with the International Space Station going from horizon to horizon in 6 or 7 minutes.
Yes.
But that's something totally different.
Yes. Oh, well, I mean, to all intents and purposes, when you're tracking spacecraft like Viking and Pioneers and Cassini and the ones that are a long way out, you really just focus on a spot in the sky. And as the Earth rotates, you compensate for that with sidereal drive.
They don't move much relative to the stars.
You wouldn't notice any if you could see them. No, that's right.
And what's perhaps been your highlight here?
Oh, that's a good question. There were so many highlights, and it's really difficult to rank them. I can give you some examples of real highlights, and of course the first one that I can remember, which was astonishing, was when the first surveyor landed softly on the moon and returned data and photographs. To me, that was just sublime. It was absolutely unreal. So I really loved that. And of course, it goes without saying, Apollo 11, likewise. But also, you know, with the soft landings on Mars too, they didn't have quite the same intensity because the lunar stuff, you had it within a few seconds of it happening, you had it back here. At Mars, I think it was something like 40 minutes after the event that we got the signal back here. It was a long time anyway, maybe not 40 minutes, but it wasn't sort of instant like Apollo and Surveyor. But I can truly say that I was astonished when the first Surveyor landed softly on the moon. It probably was the first really significant highlight for me. And then there were lots of others, as I say, Apollo 11 and subsequent Apollos too, because they have you holding your breath on the way down. And
It must be pretty exciting to know that an antenna is pointing out at a spacecraft which is leaving the solar system. Yes. As the Pioneer 10 and 11 did, of course we're not tracking them anymore, and Voyagers 1 and 2, and now of course New Horizons.
Yes, that's right, going out and going into interstellar space. That's almost beyond my comprehension. Such a long way away. Well, the signal strength that they're getting back now is so tiny too.
Just pushing over there. I'm getting a bit of wind from
The signal strengths that they're working with now, I don't know what sort of thresholds they have on the receiving equipment these days, but they are receiving such minute signals from such a long, long way away. That in itself is absolutely remarkable to me. Yeah.
So what would be the power of a transmitter on, say, Voyager, approximately?
Well, I don't know. I think they're only about 5 watts or 6 watts. They're very, very small transmitter power.
Yeah. So if it were light, which of course it's not radio waves, but if it were light, imagine a 5-watt light bulb here on Earth. If it's on the hill over here, just a kilometre away,
you'd barely see it.
You wouldn't be able to see it.
You'd barely see it. That's right. Exactly. I know.
And yet, something just with that power, yeah, we can see in radio terms.
You liken it to a light bulb, which emits light in all directions. Mm. These spacecraft are up there with very high gain dish antennas, and they point it back here in a beam, which is exactly what we do when we receive it from this thing. It's a beam.
And okay,
it's a narrow beam and a very high gain. So
we've got a 5-watt torch with a parabolic mirror behind it.
You're still
not going to see it.
Well, I know it is. It's remarkable, truly.
It's remarkable. Yeah. And so how big is this dish we're standing beside here?
This is now 70 metres in diameter. When I was here and when it was built, it was a 64 metre diameter. They've widened it a little bit, which doesn't seem very much, but it's on the outside of the antenna, of course, so the area that they've added to it is really quite good, quite big.
Mm. So. And if you could trace for us, because you're more familiar with the cabling and so on, we've got a parabolic dish in front of us here. At the moment it's pointing straight up in the sky because it's being serviced.
Yes.
Signal comes down, hits that parabola. Where does it go from there?
It hits the dish surface. It is then focused onto that dome that you see at the top of the quad.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, which refocuses it down into the receiver. Okay, so and it's what's known as a Cassegrain system. So everything that comes straight into that dish gets reflected back up there, and it gets focused down into the waveguide and down into the receiver. And I'm not quite sure what kind of receivers they use now, but when I worked here, the front end were masers,
microwave equivalent of lasers.
Yes, that's right. And they were run cryogenically, and therefore had very little introduced noise and quite big gain. So you can take a tiny signal and amplify it and not add any of your own noise to it.
Cryogenic being with liquid nitrogen?
Liquid nitrogen, yeah.
Okay, and then where does the signal go from there?
From there, it come down from the preamps up there down to the receivers, which are in the operations building, where it would be further amplified and processed, and then the data would be stripped from it. Some of it put back into space to go to be transmitted directly back to JPL. Some of it to be recorded here on the ground. Generally speaking, I don't know really what they do here now, but in our day, most of the data that we received was actually recorded here and then shipped back to the USA, because there would be far more data than you could actually transmit via landlines, you know, in the time available.
Yes.
And so you would transmit back vital data. TV, you could only, it was relatively low scan, a very low definition, but the best we could do to send that live. And even that was, you know, for the time, it was quite advanced stuff. Now, of course, they can do it in high definition, digital, and super duper. But we did things very much more basically. As was pointed out this morning, you know, the technology that's come online since this was built, most of it's become redundant. I mean, the last couple of years and it's gone. This is becoming more and more relevant.
Yes.
because it's uncovering much more knowledge, and it's never going to be redundant. It's almost going to be able to do what it does. So it's amazing, yeah.
As long as you keep painting it and keep the rust away.
Can you imagine painting that? That's a big job. Yes. It's astonishing, too. There's 3,000 tons of superstructure on that thing, floating on a film of oil.
Floating?
On a film of oil. The bearing that it rotates on is steel plates with a film of oil between them, which is pumped in under pressure, and that gives it a very, very low friction bearing to move on. Keeps it very smooth, and that's how that's supported.
So, exaggerating a bit, but if I go up there and push it with my little finger, it would start spinning around?
Oh, given that you were in a vacuum with no wind and... yeah, that's a lot of inertia, but no, very low friction and, very smooth. I believe part of what they're doing to it at the moment, I think I read on the net a week or two ago, was they're actually repacking the grout underneath that bearing. So presumably it's deteriorated and needs to be redone. So,
Well, 40 years ago.
40 years, long time, isn't it?
Yes, for any structure.
Yeah. One time, well, I can't remember the year, but it would have been probably in the early 70s, and we were on a graveyard shift and we were tracking and we were using 43, and we had an earth tremor. Here, it wasn't directly here, it was I think out near Gunning somewhere, and I think it was from memory about 4.5 on the Richter scale, but we felt it shake here. All the equipment in the operations room and the floor shook, and we lost contact with a spacecraft because that also shook, and it's such a narrow beam width, it's a tiny shake and you've lost it. And and we then had to research around in that general area to re-find the spacecraft.
Yes, someone told me this morning that it was the beam width, I think, is 1/10,000th of a degree. Yeah. Seems incredibly tiny.
Yeah, that's right. It seems very, very small, isn't it? So, any disturbance to that at all, and you're just going to lose it.
Yeah, I mean, if it's that tiny, I sort of wonder if I go alongside and jump up and down, whether or knock it off course.
I doubt it. Not 3,000 tonnes, no, I don't think so.
Okay. Are aircraft flying past, any problem?
Not that I'm aware of, no. I think aircraft actually generally are routed away from here in critical mission times.
Yes.
Launch times. Okay, or for example, when Apollo was landing, aircraft were routed away from where we'd be looking because they could have caused problems. But generally speaking, though, they're not a problem. But critical mission times, like when a spacecraft first comes over the horizon after being launched, you certainly don't want any interference at that time. So, yes, they used to do that then.
I noticed that the flights from Sydney to Melbourne and vice versa travel to the south of here. And, of course, most of the planets are to the north.
Yes, that's right, yes. I think that might be coincidental, but maybe it's not. I'm not privy to that information. I really...
Okay.
Yeah. But in answer to your question, I'm certain that we did at critical mission times have dispensation that aircraft would not fly over this area. Yeah.
So at critical mission times, do people who aren't actively involved in the tracking, people with support staff and so on, do they gather around and try to see what's happening?
No, generally speaking, the shift that was on duty would be the shift that was here. Senior management might come in for critical times, but no, the last thing you need is spectators at a time like that. Pretty dedicated bunch of blokes, all pretty expert at what they did, and working as a team, and you just don't need distractions. So in my day anyway, no, that didn't happen.
Yeah, so it seems like we saw in the movie The Dish, where there's a whole bunch of people in the control room. Yeah. Just didn't happen.
No. I was actually at Parkes, that was a very exaggerated story, and it was done for its comedic value rather than its factual value. It was a very good film, by the way, but it made me cross.
I've spoken to a lot of people who also crossed. But
not least John Saxon, I think. He was pretty upset about it.
Because some people believe what they see in the movies, don't they?
Well, yeah, unfortunately, that's what made me cross, because I realised that, yeah. Mm. Yeah. But anyway, Rob Sitch was, the guy who produced that movie or directed it, and I'm pretty sure there was a discourse between him and John Saxon.
Well, we must catch up with John sometime about that then.
Yeah, I reckon it'd be worthwhile, yeah.
Well, thanks for joining us on the Space Show, Keith.
You're very welcome, and then thanks for talking to me. I hope I haven't given you any duff gen, as we used to say in the RAF.
I was chatting with Keith Aldworth at Tidman Villa. He served there as an analogue instrumentation technician, and we'll have more about Australia's involvement in deep space tracking after these messages.
Hi, this is Archie Thompson from the Melbourne Victory for RAD, recording artists, actors and athletes against drink driving. In soccer, whether we are attacking or defending, it's important for me to stay focused. It's the same when you're on the road. Get behind the wheel of a car after you've been drinking, even if you're a little bit over, and it's easy to lose focus, lose your licence and maybe even your life. So before you go out for a drink, plan ahead. Arrange a designated driver who won't drink. The life you save might be your own.
Your voice in the community. The Great Southern Sounds of Melbourne, 88.3 Southern FM.
This is the third of three space show programs celebrating Australia's involvement in the Deep Space Network, which has now been in operation for 50 years. Wayne Sybil is the deputy manager of the Deep Space Network. He is based at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California. Last year, he came to Australia to praise Australia's role in the network. Peter Elwood caught up with him at the Canberra Deep Space Communications Network.
This is Peter Elwood. I'm at the Tidman Villa Tracking Station, and I'm out here speaking to Mr. Wayne Sybil.
How do you do?
Great, thank you, Wayne. Thanks for joining the space show. You're from Jet Propulsion Laboratory?
Right, in Pasadena, California.
And tell me what do you do there and why are you here today? Okay,
I'm the deputy manager of NASA's Deep Space Network. I'm responsible for the operations, maintenance, and care and feeding of the network worldwide, Madrid, Australia, and Mojave Desert in California. And we're down here having a yearly tag up on budgets, work, most anything we have to keep track of on a yearly basis.
And there's quite a bit of work going on here at the moment, I understand?
There is quite a bit of work. In addition to normal tracking of spacecraft and keeping them safe and healthy, we're building two antennas. The first one's going to go operational in October of 2014, and then 2 years later, the second one.
And that second antenna, what are those antennas doing? What work are they doing now, and what are they going to be doing?
Well, actually, in 2015 is when we saw a need with most of the missions getting in the southern hemisphere. We need more tracking coverage. And the Canberra site has the fewest tracking antennas of any of the three tracking sites that we have. So we wanted to augment that, the first one being available for the missions that are going to be in the southern declination so they can be tracked. We're using the new antenna plus the other three that are here.
And are all the three stations identical or very similar?
We try to complement the antennas the same. They all have a 70-meter. They all have 34 meters. At the Mojave Desert, where we generally do new things, so we test them first there. So we have five 34-meter antennas. There are two here. There are three in Madrid. So for the most part, they're somewhat the same. All the antennas are built the same. But the size and dimension, it's about 200 acres of land in Mojave Desert with antennas sprinkled around. Here it's more compact, in Madrid it's more compact. So you can fit four or five antennas within walking distance of each other.
Right. And are they all linked up together themselves, or are they totally independent, or does it go through a different center?
They can run independently, but the predicts that are needed to track the spacecraft, to know the frequencies and the position in the sky, come from JPL, central spot in JPL. The predicts are sent out about a day ahead of time, and then they configure the antennas so they can track whatever missions they're going to track. There's about 30-plus missions that we track each week. The contact time ranges from minutes for low Earth, you know, Earth orbiter type missions and ones at the moon, to a 12-hour pass for a Voyager or a Cassini. They have a long view period, so they're tracked for a long period of time. And the more antennas we have, the more performance we can get because we can array them together and enhance the signal reception.
And the image or the data that goes through these stations, I mean, you track or you receive information as well as send?
Right, yeah. We send the commands to the spacecraft that allow the instruments on board to collect the science, do whatever they need to do, housekeeping type information, maneuver it, move it around in the sky. And then the data comes back through these antennas back to JPL and then out to the missions that are located all out around the world. We track NASA missions, European Space Agency missions, Japanese missions, and we're about to track a Mars mission that's being launched from India.
Okay. Do you have any, I mean, you mentioned India. Do you have anything to do with the Chinese space program and any other space program?
No, mainly India, the Europeans, the Japanese, some Canadians, most anybody we track. We haven't been asked to support any Chinese missions. They're building their own set of networks and track them and build them themselves.
You probably won't answer this, but do you eavesdrop on any missions you think might be interesting that you don't officially have access to?
That's not our network. Our network is specifically geared towards scientific missions, so any defense-related items we're not really involved with. The Deep Space Network is managed by Caltech, which is a university that's under contract to NASA. And everything we do is all scientifically based. The U.S. has other networks and things to track those kind of defense-related items. So we stay strictly science.
And none of your stuff is Earth orbit, it's all deep space?
All deep space. You may have met John Walker. He manages all three networks, the Space Network, Ground Network, and the Deep Space Network from NASA headquarters. The near-Earth network tracks all the missions that are in Earth orbit. So they have a little bit smaller antennas because they can go through the sky faster and track Earth orbiters that are traveling much faster across the sky. And then we track the ones that are in deep space, anything from the moon on out.
Very good. And are you having any sort of early sort of involvements in the whatever the next phase of the deep space exploration for the NASA program, manned program?
Yes. Actually, we're in the study phase now of trying to figure out which of our antennas we'd use for the human spaceflight. There are some demonstration missions coming up that are non-manned that will demonstrate our ability to track at the frequencies they have, the reliability they have. There's two unmanned before they would even get to one where they're going to have humans in it. But they're planning to use it. See, formerly the near-Earth network and the space network tracked the space station and the shuttle and trips to the moon. We supported that moon activity, but we were just supporting it. Now, anything that gets out past the moon, we're the only network that does that. So we have to be really reliable and capable and have a robust way of returning data up in the, you know, quadruple nines, you know, 99.99% of all the data that's available we get.
So just in general, what are your thoughts? I'll be here for the 40th anniversary of DSS 43, and how do you find working with the Australian government, Australian people, CSIRO?
Oh, I love working with the Australians, the Spaniards. This is great. They always treat us very, very nicely when we come over here. They're extremely intelligent and love the work. That's what you really enjoy coming down here. Everybody you saw in there today, they love this work. They come out on the weekends, and then the best special event, they just want to be there. They want to be a part of it. And that's what makes NASA and the scientific community just so much fun to work in. You know, everybody's so excited about it. When you see the 70-meter, it's a big, big piece of hardware that has to keep running. And the staff that's here, we spent the last week with them, you know, the guys that turn the cranks, the guys that deal with the electronics, they're all proud of what they do, and they want to keep that thing running forever.
Well, given it is the 40th anniversary, there's actually a lot of old-timers here,
yes.
People that predate you and I.
Yes.
And you're right. You can see the enthusiasm that they still have that you experience and describe today, and it's just a wonderful community.
Yeah, and I saw the photos. I was at JPL when the Curiosity lander landed on Mars, and they had pictures of what was going on here, and this place was packed with visitors, people just going nuts over the activity. They came in, it was middle of the night for them, and it was just you think about all the people that get engaged in this in exploring space, and then and you've got a whole group of them down here, especially Glenn Nagel. Glenn's the guy that runs the visitor center here. Well, he just loves this work. He just loves it.
So tell me about yourself. How did you get involved? You work for JPL?
I work for JPL. I got involved with JPL 34 years ago. I came in as a operations person dealing with the Voyager spacecraft. I was on the fight team. Then I moved into programming, and I spent a couple of years doing programming and then went to work on the Galileo project and did software development for the Galileo project at Jupiter. Stayed on that project for almost 18 years, leaving as the deputy project manager. And now I'm working at DSN, spent the last 10 years here, love it. It's I deal with everything from roads to electronics and low noise amplifiers, and it's a wide range of items to have to deal with. There's never a dull day.
And how's your Spanish?
My Spanish is a little poor. Fortunately, they all speak English, everybody we deal with, so it makes it fun. Now, Australian English is a little bit different than U.S. English, as I find out every trip down here, but it is fun. I enjoy being down here.
Well, listen, thank you very much. We appreciate you coming down and spending time with us on the Space Show, and have a great time here and good trip back.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much. My pleasure.
That was Wayne Seibel, the Deputy Manager of the Deep Space Network. And while at Tidbinbilla, Peter Iwood also had a chat with John Walker, the Operations Manager of NASA's Tracking Networks.
This is Peter Iwood at Tidbinbilla Tracking Station, and I have a special guest with me, Mr. John Walker.
Good morning.
John, you're out here from the US, and you're with NASA in charge of the Deep Space Tracking Network. Could you explain exactly what your role is?
Gladly. I'm the operations manager for our tracking networks that NASA runs, and the Canberra Deep Space Communication Complex here is one of the stations I manage. We've been meeting with our Australian colleagues here this week. I've had a very interesting time. We were talking about budgets, operations, how they're doing, what missions we're tracking, and the people are doing an outstanding job here. We're very happy with the Australian effort.
But John, you were just talking about your work out here at the moment. You're out here to review some work that's going on?
Right. We try to keep an eye on the wonderful work our colleagues here in Australia are doing for us managing this tracking station. And so we discuss with them budgets, how much things are costing, the great work they're doing, what progress they're making on building the new antenna, for example. We're putting in a new 35-meter antenna. Quite a bit of work. They're going to lift the aperture in a couple weeks, so they're quite far along on that. So we discuss with them the progress. I hear from the facilities folks, logistics, all the operations crews, and we, you know, basically discuss how the site's going and how the management's working.
So we're out here celebrating the 40th anniversary of DSS 43, and I understand that's undergoing some upgrades at the moment?
Right. So it's in a DLM. When I first started working for NASA, we used so many acronyms, I couldn't understand a word anybody was saying. A DLM is a depot level maintenance. So you go down and you scrape to bare metal so you can repaint, but also we replaced a lot of cabling and we replaced the runner, the steel track that the antenna rotates on so it can point to the proper spacecraft. And that's been a lot of work. That's been in work since last November, I believe. So they finished with all the runner work and regrouting. The grout gets old, oil gets into it, it starts to crumble. So that's all been replaced. They've finished the cabling, so now we're just getting the antenna control unit up to speed and all that kind of thing. So that should be back online within a month or so.
Okay, so the facilities run by CSIRO for NASA. And so do they, like, is the antennas that being built and being modified, is that built in Australia? Is it all built in the US and brought out? How does that kind of work?
It's some of all of the above. So the antenna was actually, the aperture was built in Spain. And I think General Dynamics, both here and in the States, is doing all the aperture, the steelwork, the structure. And the Australian, there's Australian local companies that did all the concrete work and the cable trenches and all the roadways and facilities. So it really is an international effort to build one of these massive antennas.
Now, obviously, NASA's undergoing some budget challenges, as the world is. How's that affecting what you're doing here? Is it sort of year to year the way you have to plan things, or you have a longer cycle?
we have about a seven-year cycle where we plan for the next 7 years. Now, yes, we are under serious budget pressure. If you read the newspaper, I think most countries are, and we're doing our best to spend our money wisely and as efficiently as we can, and we're doing a good job of that here. And that's one of the reasons I'm out here, to get good ideas from the local folks on ways to save money. I mean, I could certainly dictate cut this or cut...
John...
And I just wanted to add that, in case it wasn't picked up earlier, that I'm expecting, and I do get from the local people here, the Australian crews working on the site, their good ideas on ways to be more efficient and help us spend our, I got to say, meager dollars wisely. So, you know, we could dictate how to do cuts or how to do this or that, but these guys are the experts.
The Space Show's Peter Arwood in conversation with John Walker, who is the operations manager of NASA's Tracking Networks. Jeffrey Blush often showed his interest in space affairs during his four-year term as United States Ambassador to Australia. He fostered and supported cooperation between our countries. In April last year, the Space Show went up to Canberra and recorded Mr. Blush's speech commemorating the 40th anniversary of the Deep Space Station 43 antenna at Tidbinbilla. That speech is now available for download from the Space Show website. Now, just after that speech, Peter Arwood had this conversation with the Ambassador.
This is Peter Arwood at Tidbinbilla Tracking Station, and we have a very special guest with me, Mr. Jeffrey Blush, the U.S. Ambassador to Australia. Welcome to the Space Show.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thanks, Peter.
You're here to celebrate with us the 40th anniversary of the Deep Space Tracking Dish, DSS-43. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts, feelings of today?
Oh, it's a very special day. This is the largest dish we have in the world. It's a 70-meter dish, and it was one of our oldest and most important. It's tracked everything from Voyager to the Mars Space Lab, the Curiosity landing. And it's just been recently refurbished, and she's ready to go another 40 years, and she looks terrific. And so I think it's a real testament to the history of the relationship between the U.S. and Australia on space tracking, but also a real statement about our future and what we're planning on doing in the years ahead.
I understand you come out here a bit. You live in Canberra, obviously. Do you bring people out here quite often?
Yeah, I'm a bit of a groupie. I come out here. I am just in awe of the accomplishments of our scientists in space. And so I like to come out here and sort of share that experience with others and have them appreciate just what we've done together. I mean, at a time when when this dish went up, they hadn't even invented the personal computer, and people were listening to music on 8-track tapes, and the only video game that existed was Pong. And yet, at the same time, we produced an antenna which is going to last, as I said, you know, another half century at least, and is tracking the furthest objects in space, human-made objects in space, including Voyagers 1 and 2.
That's right. And this facility is not a history facility. It's working. It's being upgraded as we speak. And I understand there's a new dish going in.
There is. In fact, there's a whole array that's going up right now. And my favorite thing about that dish is when we broke ground on it, I asked some of the engineers and scientists, what are we going to be tracking with this? And they said, yeah, that's the beauty of it. We have no idea. And that is the beauty of it. Beauty of it is that we have confidence in each other and in future generations that they're going to design and build things that will achieve remarkable discoveries, and that we're going to have the equipment to allow that to happen.
Wonderful. I'm not sure whether you've had any time. I know Australia has released its space policy during the week. Have you had a look at that? Have you got any thoughts or impressions?
I have, and we have a whole team here which is focused on the science and space relationship with Australia. And I think it's positive. It's a very positive document.
Very good. Well, we look forward to working with the U.S. NASA and the U.S. government and people on Future in Space. And thank you for joining us on the Space Show.
Well, I look forward to another great occasion out here at Tidbinbilla when we get the other Peter.
Well, I'll see you at the 80th. Thank
you.
Peter Arwood with the then United States Ambassador Jeffrey Blush at the Tidbinbilla Space Tracking Station. Now, this has been the third in a trio of interview programs highlighting Australia's role in the Deep Space Network. The DSN is 50 years old this year. The series was produced and presented by Andrew Rennie. The interviews were by Andrew Rennie and Peter Arwood. Now, this series will be available for download from the 2014's interviews page at www.southernfm.com.au/space. Now, Southern FM is one word in lowercase, southernfm.com.au/space. And we hope to have it up in about a week's time, although the first two programs are already up on the net. There will also be some supporting photographs for you to peruse. Well, they track spacecraft to the deepest sections of the solar system. And we've got a song here which I don't think happened to the Deep Space Network, but you never know. It's called Apollo Lost. Did they ever lose a spacecraft? Well, Apollo Lost, this is by Cynthia McQuillan and Catherine Cook.
Is done, and I say your words are hollow, and our work has just begun. Say to me, we need the money just to feed the poor, and I say, gee, that's funny, it's for them that we explore. Say to me, we should be fighting. Say to me, the world's at war, and I say, we are uniting people tired of war and more. Say to me, there's too much danger. Say we could be lost, and I say, I am no stranger to danger, that's the cost. Say to me, our world is dying, ready for its last hurrah, and I cry, keep on trying, we must find our Shangri-La. Say to me, no more Apollo. Say to me, the job is done, and I say, your words are hollow, and our work has just begun, and our work has just begun.